Talk given Saturday, 13 September 1980. Whatsoever we see, truly see, of the truth of life has an extraordinary transmutative power. It changes the individual altogether. It changes him and at the same time enables his problems, as we call them, to disappear. It's not so much a case of the problem being solved as that a resolution takes place in the whole of the psyche, which clears out of our total being all that obstructs good living, pure living. That's what it amounts to. Most of the problems that we have are, perhaps all our problems, are due to our own making. We are responsible for them. We have not understood the situation. We do not know ourselves properly. We do not know the other people or the circumstances with which we deal. We do not see all that in the right way, in the clean, clear-sighted way. And therefore, all these problems and difficulties afflict us. The conflicts, the sorrows, and also the successes and the pleasures of the world, they all afflict us, if only we knew. Because, after all, consider, what is our source to which we, if we are seriously interested in the religious life, are trying to relate ourselves, to be in relationship with it completely? What is our source? Isn't it transcendence itself, the one total reality, which is fundamentally a cosmos? That means the activity of all the creative energy that there is in the maintenance of an harmonious order. And this is the important thing to realize. We may see, as astronomers, great galaxies colliding, and we say, what a catastrophe. But that which is a catastrophe to us at our limited level and on our small scale is part and parcel of the great cosmic order and harmony in the cosmic process. We can't get away from that. Very well. To transcendence we relate ourselves. In transcendence we live and move and have our being. There is no getting away from that as a fundamental fact, a fundamental truth. So, our task is not to be obstructive to that in which we live and move and have our being. So, if we apply what we see, what we learn, truly learn, in the religious sense and in the religious context, then every other context in which we function, political, economic, social, educational, the world of health, and all the rest of it, all that would undergo transformation for us to start with. But it's a tremendous transformation. And since each person, however much he may imagine he is separate from the rest of the world, each person is actually in is in full relationship with the external world, a relationship which is like a web from which he cannot extricate himself, even if he tried. He tries to extricate himself by all his folly and absurdity and so on, but he doesn't really succeed, because when he lives foolishly, wrongly, impurely, all that comes back upon him and on those around him in terms of conflict and of sorrow and of pain. So you see, this relating back to transcendence, being in tune with it, in rhythm with the creative process, means that we as individuals are changed and we affect our whole society. In fact, we affect the whole of humanity, because there is only one humanity, the one tree of human life, which, like trees in the plant world, which cast off their leaves when the season comes and then sprout new ones, the tree of humanity just goes on and on and on. It doesn't die. It is the leaves which fall off. They perish, as we call, as we say. But in their perishing, they are sustenance for the soil and for that very tree which grows in that soil. So our perishing as psychophysical beings, whether we are failures or successes, as we call it, in an extraordinary manner, nourishes and sustains the soil in which the tree of humanity flourishes. Because one can go on and on quite a great deal with a question like that. That's a very good question to ask. Thank you.
If you were asked what you were actually, or what we have been discussing together over the years, Rose, the basis of it, what would you say?
Well, just, haven't I already answered that? We are trying to, if we are seriously interested in living the religious life, which means, never forget, me living the purely human life, the fully human life, if we are seriously interested in that, that is what we are learning all the time and growing accordingly, changing accordingly. I think your question didn't get recorded. No, I shall have to repeat the question so that we know what I'm talking about.
Would you equate the word transcendence with the word freedom? Or is freedom not quite transcendence or not quite good enough here?
The question is, would you equate the word transcendence with freedom? That is essentially the question.
Yes.
The word transcendence stands, as far as I am concerned, with the total reality, whatsoever it may be. That which we can see, which we can't see, that which we will be able to see when we as individuals move towards fruition, and that which remains quite outside our scope, whether we reach fruition or not. Because the totality is so vast, it's infinite. Never forget that. See, our context is the context of the finite, the temporal, and the mortal. The context of transcendence, which is the true religious context, is the context of the infinite, the non-measurable, either in terms of bigness or in terms of littleness. Both ways, they are immeasurable. So that the context of transcendence is that immeasurable, infinite, it is eternity, which completely includes, subsumes both time and timelessness. And thus, by obvious deduction, it is also the context of immortality. Now, that being its context, and itself being the primordial creative energy at work, you see, working in eternity, its activity is in eternity, not merely in time and timelessness, and all our mortal and activity in time is subsumed within that eternal. That is true. You see? So now, all these words like freedom or beauty, all the spiritual values as we call them, they are all words which suggest something of the nature of the activity of this primordial creative energy. The energy itself and pure consciousness itself remain the everlastingly unknown to mankind. You see? And the expression of that energy acting in eternity, if sensed by us in certain ways, we call freedom. You see? You may look at it another way too. This activity of creative energy in eternity is the root meaning of the word karma. You see, we talk about karma and we have hopelessly inadequate meanings given to it through the ages, in the East and the West alike. Karma is from kri, to make, to do. Now, making and doing belong to a context of mortality, of finitude. You make a piano, you make a building, you make your lunch, or you do some job. You see, you are a dustman, or you're a producer in a theater, or whatever it is. You do, you see. Now, make and do apply to the realm of the finite, the temporal, and the mortal. You can't apply that to transcendence itself, the primordial creative energy which releases the entire cosmos. You and I can't make a cosmos. We can't do anything about a cosmos as such. It is that primordial creative energy which does it. And this is the root meaning of the word karma, action in eternity. And in that action in eternity are subsumed all the spiritual values that we know of, that we can experience for ourselves at our level, in our human condition, which is divine enough if only we really understood it and could live up to it. It's very difficult. This expansion of consciousness which people seek. Really means not having all sorts of almost supernatural experiences in mind or states of consciousness and so on. Consciousness in us is very limited, of course, as human beings. It can become free. It is consciousness which becomes freer and freer. It can become free to an extent sufficient to enable that sense of transcendence to function in such a manner within us that we are aware that the context of transcendence does wholly subsume the context of the finite and the mortal.
You said on the last occasion we met, the Garden of Eden goes on all the time. What is that effect? Do you mind explaining what you meant by that?
What is the Garden of Eden for myself, the individual? What is the Garden of Eden?
The origin of the universe.
No. For myself, the individual. It's the whole psychophysical organism. That is the Garden of Eden. Within it are all the trees and the flowers and the fruits which of which we partake as we live and in order to live. Consider the body very, very carefully. The tree of good and evil, as it was miscalled, and the tree of life are both said to be in the middle of the Garden of Eden. Now you can't have two trees, two different trees, and especially two trees which are supposed to be somewhat unlike each other, you see, both existing in the same place. It's not possible. We can understand it this way. What is this tree of life as far as the psychophysical organism is concerned? It's the brain, the nervous system, the spine. This is where all yogis should spend much time meditating on what it all means and what are its significances. That is the central tree of life as far as we are concerned. For us. Now, the fruit of that tree of life, what is the fruit of that tree? It's not an apple, not even a cox. You see? Nor is it an orange, nor is it a peach or anything. What is the fruit of this tree of life in man?
Consciousness.
Consciousness, that's right, well done. That's it, you see. Consciousness is the fruit of this tree. Now, the fruit, the full fruit, the ripe fruit of that tree is the pure consciousness which emerges in us through our purification and perfecting, process of perfecting. Now, Adam was asked by the woman, or rather, the woman, as she was called, was tempted. She wasn't tempted at all. She was told certain things. She looked upon the tree, saw that the fruit was good. She saw quite rightly, because the woman in the first part of Genesis is no other than Bina, which is intelligence, true intelligence, the feminine counterpart of Chokhmah, wisdom. You see, she is the feminine counterpart. And she is the one referred to as the woman, Esha. And Esha, the name, means the daughter of Esh, which is the creative fire, the sacred fire. You see? Now, Esha plucks of the fruit, the ripe fruit of the tree of life, and eats it. Nothing happens to her, because she is already part of the divine divine essence, the trinity of the crown, the Kether Elyon, Chokhmah, and Bina, the divine triad. But Adam, he of the ground, Adam has several meanings. You take the Aleph, the first letter, A, and Dam. Aleph, the creative power, enclosed in a bag of blood. Dam, you see, enclosed in a. Also, the word Adam means he of the ground. That the ground meaning not merely just the earth, the physical planet as such, but the sort of root material out of which all the different forms and shapes of the root material have found expression throughout universal creation. The ground here corresponds to the Hindu Prakruti in the Sankhya philosophy. Prakruti. Primordial nature, that's what it is, you see. All right, so Adam is he of the ground, but he's not yet developed enough to be able to take the mature fruit of the tree of life, the pure consciousness, he has to learn and he has to grow quite a lot. And so what happens is that he is like a person who has received a knock on the head with a, what is that weapon called? Bernard Shaw uses it.
Knob Kerry.
He's been knocked on the head with a knob Kerry, you see. And so he's all confused and dizzy like I am at the moment. He's quite dizzy with it all, you see. So he goes out of Eden. But you can't go out of your psychophysical organism as such. He goes out of Eden in the sense that he can no longer utilize Eden in the full sense, in the proper manner. And he has to earn his bread by the sweat of his brow. Sweat of his brow we can understand for those days, but if he had been living in the Garden of Eden, where was bread? Nobody made bread. Eve didn't. In fact, there was no Eve then. Eve comes later on the scene. It's after the separation of Adam and Esha that Eve steps into the picture. It's all a very complex story, and it's a very difficult thing to unravel properly. But try and follow it if you can, you see. And let me see, where were we? We were talking about
separation.
Yes, the separation of the two, of the woman and Adam, and then Adam knows Eve. Eve comes on the scene, which is the earthly prototype of expression, counterpart of the divine woman, Esha. Man actually is composed of two androgynes constituting him, the divine androgyne and the earthly androgyne, man-woman in one. That is why every female body has an anima and every male body has an animus. Other way around. Every female body has an animus and every male body has an anima. So we have the earthly androgyne is what psychologists know of and talk of. They don't know about the divine androgyne, which only those who have sort of entered into these things and penetrated into the esoteric, Kabbalistic and Vedic teachings, they know something about it, or they think that they know. However, that may be. So, yes, you asked the question about the Garden of Eden. So, you see, our task is not to return to the Garden of Eden, but by going through the whole cycle of experience and development and suffering and so on, at last coming to the position where we truly see the fact, the truth of things, and understand it all. Then this thing, this psychophysical organism, once again is a veritable Garden of Eden. Here, this is where the great yogis did realize. And that is why they talked of the consequences of proper yogic development and training in the manner in which they talked. I won't go into that, partly because I don't know all of what they talked, but that's what it is. It represents your fruition. Then, once again, this psychophysical organism is no obstruction to you or to the energy of transcendence pouring into you as a nexus, as a container, the Holy Grail. The body, the person becomes the Holy Grail, and it flows out towards everyone and everything in his environment. So the Garden of Eden is a wonderful, wonderful teaching, if only we could understand it properly. And that's where the difficulty lies.
It's Jewish in origin, isn't it?
Kabbalistic. Or the Jewish teachings, the Old Testament, etc., are all derived out of the old Kabbalah. The Kabbalah was an oral tradition handed down. You see, one great advantage of keeping it as an oral tradition was that it would be handed down only to those who were really fit. You put dynamite into the hands of the wrong person and see what he does.
Would you say, Firoz, that personal relationships is really the testing ground of any teaching?
It certainly is the most searching testing ground of what we have truly seen and understood. Because the major portion of our conflicts are with other people. We can't get along with them, and so forth. And if we look into our own selves with really searching eyes, we will always discover that the fault, the main fault, major fault, lies within ourselves. Our own egoism, our own vanity, our own possessiveness, and so forth. All these things play their part. Our own innate cruelty, our own self-conceit that we are such and such, and you know what a wonderfully good opinion each one has of himself. Well, all that contributes towards the conflicts and the struggles and the sorrow which comes in consequence. And the passion for pleasure, the passion for power. These are, I'm using the word passion, but the word lust, the English word lust is by far the better word there. The lust for pleasure and the lust for power, those are two of the great devils which have absolutely bedeviled human history through the centuries, everywhere, East and West alike. Individual becoming rich and powerful, dominating others, you know, etc. Then he says, well, look at the first chapter of Genesis, and the Lord God gave man dominion over this, that, and the other. And how horribly and magnificently horribly he has misinterpreted the idea of having dominion. Dominus, the Lord, is the one who looks after you, protects you. His main job is to protect you. You see, with the strength of his right arm, he supports you, saves you from being destroyed and so forth. That is the meaning of dominus. Not to dominate, nothing to do with dominating, but to serve. And dominion, see how wonderful it is, dominion over all the creatures and the plants. Now, serve the creatures and the plants. How wonderful it becomes. In the Zohar, these five volumes here, if you look through them, you will see that the animal kingdom is associated with the archangels. And in Zarathustrian teaching, the first of the great archangels, Bahman, or Vahu Mano, which means the good mind, the purified mind. You see, Vahu Mano is the lord of the animal world and the protector of the animal world. See, after all, where did what we call mind come from? Out of an animal body. We have developed all that out of an animal body. And so dominion means that. That is true lordship.
And not destroying 50 million whales.
Quite true. Quite true. To nourish, to sustain, maintain, that is our task. And that is true dominion. In the old legends and histories and so on, he whose domains extended over all the land and who was regarded as the good king. Why was he regarded as the good king? Because he sustained them, protected them, brought happiness to them. And what do we do today? Look at the east of the Western world, by which I mean, say, the Soviet Union and the United States, everyone sort of involved in a ghastly tangle. The lust for power and possessions, for wealth.
Yes, but having said all that, you see, how do we use power? And you've said many times, power is invariably misused. Right. But then you see, someone has to execute.
How do we use power?
Misuse it, of course. But we still have to use it.
So the question is, how can we use power rightly?
Well, again, the word rightly is a contentious word.
Yes.
But what's right to one is wrong to somebody else, and so on.
No, we can cut that out, you see. Because if we are truly concerned with living the human life, the pure life, then we are involved with all other human beings in the world. What concerns us, our happiness, our fulfillment and fruition and so forth, implies also the well-being, the happiness and the fruition and fulfillment of all other human beings. Therefore, if all of us were so brought up from infancy onwards and so educated that we understood that we are part and parcel of all humanity and are completely interrelated and interacting with all humanity, then we would truly be able to consider together what is required under the immediate circumstances and plan out something. And if we plan, we are most likely then to plan out rightly. And if we find that it doesn't sort of go right, there is still this difficulty or that difficulty, we can experiment with our plan for a while and then change it. But people don't want to change once they have decided upon a course of action. They are very rigid. This is due to our egoism and self-conceit. Our vanity is hurt also, if we say that I was wrong. But one of the most releasing things which enables you to heave the largest sigh of relief you ever heaved is to be able to say to yourself, my goodness, I was wrong. See, this is the point. So, the right use of power comes only because there is the willingness to work together for the benefit of everybody. Look at England itself, for instance. What has been our jolly old history of our parliamentary democracy? Each party in power is vilified by the party out of power. And they said, just waste their time slamming each other, whilst in the meantime everything moves towards the precipice, and in some respects has gone over the precipice. So there we are. But if they just sat down together and said, no, not our interests, not my interests, but the interests of the whole, the interests of the totality, And if they had a truly religious sense, they would, with that sort of attitude, and with all their energies directed in that manner, they would draw down upon themselves an extraordinary fund of pure creative energy, which is always available for the pure people. And that's that. Of course, the people of the world will just say, oh, this is all airy-fairy, idealistic hot air, and it's just rubbish. These people don't understand the economic problems and so forth. You won't solve any economic problems until you understand the economist. That is oneself. You see, this is how they shirk their responsibilities. They won't accept fairly and squarely on their own shoulders their own responsibility. First and foremost, to understand themselves and all the psychological forces within themselves which are destroying human beings and the world and world resources and all the rest of it. How do we have an oil crisis? Because we are just using it up for our particular purposes, which are first and foremost to be well off.
Firoz, at the summer school, one of the most important remarks made was by John Blofeld, who told us the virtue of frugality. And that has really stuck in my mind. Because it's not just food, it's
everything.
Thoughts and ideas.
Exactly,
you know?
Exactly.
And it would work.
One of the curses of our time is that man is out of touch with the feeling side of his nature.
Yes.
He does not know what he feels. And therefore, in the what he thinks is a comfortable not knowing, he can quite cheerfully torture his neighbour. But if he felt as a human being should feel, he couldn't do it. And it breeds a tremendous amount of neurosis in our time.
Quite true.
That dichotomy between head and feet, head and heart.
Surely, though, Firoz, isn't the religious life and the world, aren't they incompatible?
The religious life and what actually exists as the worldly life, they are incompatible with each other. The worldly life and the mentality of the worldling has brought humanity to this present impasse and this terribly difficult situation and state. What will cure it? What will cure it? Only the religious life, in the true sense. The religious life means a full understanding of the fact that we are one humanity and we are interrelated all together. And we have to work together, but not work with the same psychical driving forces inside us to become wealthy, to become powerful, to satisfy our lusts, to enjoy life, as we call it, in the way which leads us only to death, the real death, what is called in the Jewish writings, a dead death, maut hamaut, a dead death from which there is no resurrection whatsoever. You see? And you're not even good dead material to sustain the soil or anything. You sustain nothing. So if people do realize that, they will see that the only way to live the religious life is to live in the world and oneself undergo the transformation under the conditions of challenge of all the evil forces of the world. And we must remember not to fight against the evil forces. That strengthens them. When two lads wrestle together, each is strengthening the other. Never forget that. nations fighting each other strengthen each other. Strengthen each other which way? First of all, psychologically, in terms of hate and revenge, the passion for revenge. And so the silly old game goes on and on and on till people destroy themselves altogether. So you don't fight against the evil. You have to understand it. This togetherness, sitting down together and trying to understand the actuality of the situation, which includes the actuality of what we are. I am greedy, I am vengeful, I am fearful, and so forth. Now, each one of us has to tackle that within himself. Any plans, any schemes that we put out represent perfectly what we ourselves are in our own character. Look at the peace treaty conferences after a war. Each side is trying to grab the best for itself and down the other nation so that it can never again rise up and cause us to go to war. And see what happened with two world wars in our own lifetime. See what happened. The defeated people were the ones who had to be supplied with money and so on by us in order that they may be able to start up their own economy. Why? Not for their sakes, but in order that we may trade with them, make more money, etc., etc., etc. You see, the pathetic and stupendous stupidity of mankind in all this. They just don't see. The world is a vast lunatic asylum. And it doesn't even give asylum. It lets loose the lunatics. That's the trouble.
Insanity fair,
true enough. No, this is the great thing. We have to see this as one of the great truths of life, our responsibility. And that is part of religious insight. Then there are so many good-natured people who say, oh, it's my responsibility to do good this way and that way. But I, the idiot, will attempt to do the good according to my conditioned ideas and my mistakes and everything. So I put all that into my actions, and lo and behold, 20 years later, I scratch my head and say, why was I such a fool? Well, you needn't have been. One needs common gumption. One of the world's great shortages.
What is insight?
Seeing the fact as the fact. Seeing the truth of the thing. Not imagining that it is something is like this, that or the other when it isn't. Very few of us are capable of clear-sightedness. This is the trouble.
What is truth, said Pilate? That's a very common one.
It's a question which need never be answered, for the very simple reason that as oneself becomes purified and grows, you become that truth, and your becoming that truth in mind and consciousness enables you to live your everyday life in such a manner, naturally and spontaneously, that truth is expressed. And you yourself are usually unaware of it. You see, that is the thing. It's no good asking what is truth and expecting a white paper from a society or a special report from some experts. This is truth. That's totally impossible. Truth, everything that lives is growing. So, the truth realized in this state of growth, of clear perception, if you say that that's the final truth, then you're going to decay and die. You're going to stagnate. You grow and you grow and you grow. The truth grows with you. I am the way, the truth, and the life. The living person is the truth. Sri Krishna said it. Jesus said it. Some of the great teachers of the Upanishads pointed that out. I can't remember whether Zarathustra put it in his writings. Or rather, the gathas which are ascribed to him,